Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
February 15, 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this is indeed the show you are looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Anyway, Wednesday, Woden's Day, middle of the week, and I am more than happy to tell you that the first time this show went live was 2014 on exactly this day, February 15. So that's how long I've been doing this live. Did I do the show before it? Yes, I did. Who knows? Maybe you guys will hear that in the upcoming re-releases of podcasts. Since all these platforms have taken my stuff down, I figure I'll re-release stuff. But anyway, that is something that I'm going to discuss in the very near future on the show. Tonight, who do I have with me? Well, this is interesting because, quite frankly, I'm hypercritical, right, of a lot of the JFK-oriented media that's put out there. You guys know this. I always pay attention to it. It doesn't matter if MSNBC does it, if Fox News does it, if the Business Channel does it, if the History Channel does it, if your news media outlets do it. It doesn't matter at all. One way or another, I'm hypercritical, always alerted. Well, funny thing. I wasn't aware of a podcast recently, and a friend of mine pointed it out to me, and I went and checked it out, and I thought to myself, this is probably not going to be good. And the guy I have with me tonight, it turns out it is good. Now, I didn't listen to all of it. He's got quite a few episodes out, and I don't know how far he's gone because I purposely turned it off so that you and I, you guys, the listeners, and myself could learn together from Matt Crumpton, who has put out kind of a JFK-related podcast with a rather ambitious title. In my mind. Matter of fact, overly ambitious title. That was my first point of resentment, Matt. Matt has no idea what I'm going to say about any of this, by the way. So, unscripted as always, Matt Crumpton is with me. No relation to Daniel Lewis Crumpton that I know of. But anyway, that's a guy who used to be on my show quite a bit. But I don't believe you're related to him. I didn't ask yet.
No.
But anyway.
No relation.
Anyway, we'll get to this. Solving JFK. Okay?
Yeah.
Solving JFK. Hell of a thing. Solving JFK. Okay, considering the fact that I've personally been involved for way more than a quarter century steadily studying this case, okay, contributing to people's research, doing presentations, 10 years with this radio show, now it's not my primary focus, but it's always there. It is the reason why I ended up doing this. It is the reason why I've gone to conferences. It is the reason why, even though I only have a high school diploma, I've lectured at universities. It is that reason. Okay. But hell of a tall order, solving JFK.
Right.
And I went into it really with not such a good attitude. And I was just like, oh no, what is he going to do? And I was fascinated. Why? Because first thing I'll tell you is his level of production is excellent. Okay. He's got a good voice. Everything is well laid out, logical, all right? And the funny thing is, I'm going to have him explain, because, you know, you hear a title like Solving JFK, you might have thoughts here. Okay, he's going to tell us his version of how this worked, one way or another. And that's not quite what I got. So, Matt, I'm done trying to explain this, because, again, I'm not as far along in your stuff as I could be. I purposely stopped. I'm going to listen to the rest of it. So for the record, everybody, I didn't stop because I'm not going to finish listening.
Yeah.
I'm going to go through the rest of this. But how are you doing tonight, first of all? And maybe you can help me explain Solving JFK better.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on, Chuck. I appreciate it. And thanks for your candor and also the kind words. In terms of the name Solving JFK, I realized pretty early on that it was ridiculous. I don't know if you know Lisa Pease. She's well known for her work with RFK.
Right, and also working alongside Jim DiEugenio. She wrote over and over again. Many different publications Lisa Pease has written for. I'm well aware. Yep, go ahead.
She's great. So I kind of befriended her, and then she kind of gave me a friendly little ribbing. Oh, really? Solving JFK, are you?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's, I, I believe in the first episode, like the prologue episode, I kind of address like how ridiculous the name is. It's a combination of you got to have a name, and kind of all the names are hard to or sound stupid. I always tell people, hey, Goo Goo Dolls is a band name that had commercial success. You know what I mean? So you got to have a name.
Wait a second. Goo Goo Dolls is not loaded, though. See, a Goo Goo Doll is a Goo Goo Doll. It's just goofy. This is beyond goofy because, right. You know, look, for the general public, and by the way, there's a trailer, and I'm going to give you guys the link to his trailer. I'm going to give you guys the link to the podcast, the YouTube channel. All that is going to be in the show notes. Whatever it is Matt wants you guys to go look at. I advise you to actually catch the whole trailer because the trailer does explain this. But I figured let's have you reword it tonight.
Yeah.
I love it but it's a loaded name. And the interesting thing is it's loaded for people like me who have, you know, spent way too much time, energy, money on this. Okay. You know, literally personally investigating it. It's way loaded for me, but it's also way loaded to the general pedestrian who's sort of a drive-by, you know, a rubbernecker, if you will, on this, who has an interest solving JFK. So this guy has a solution. Now, somebody who isn't intensely involved might say, let's see what his solution is. They might be open-minded. Somebody who has just a passing interest, even less than that, not even a real intense interest where they're always going to turn their head, also is going to look at this and say, solving JFK? Maybe this guy actually knows, and he's got the new information. Let's tune to it.
Yeah.
So across the board, you got a bunch of different ways this can be loaded, depending on the mentality of the person who encounters it. So frankly, at first I was bothered by it, and then after I thought about it, I said, oh, this is actually brilliant. So go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a fair criticism, and you know, once I realized kind of how it was being received by a lot of people, I did go out of my way in the first episode to say that, you know, I think I know a lot about this case. I've spent about 20 years reading books on it and about 3 years outlining with citations, like that level of granularity. But there's still probably, you know, I would say, you know, 5 to 10,000 people in the United States that know more than me. Mm. Well, you're one of them. So,
well, let me ask you this really quick.
Maybe
because you
30,
mentioned the
maybe
books.
50, maybe it's a bigger number. I don't even know.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you the truth. There's about 1,000 people in the United States that I guarantee have what would be considered expert level knowledge on the case. I don't count myself among them. Some people do count me among them. I don't count myself there because I don't have that kind of ego. But the thing about this is, how many books? I just wanted this one quick question. How many books would you say you've read? And then I want to answer whatever number you give. I mean, you don't have to remember it exactly, and I do want to know the books that you completed, not skimmed. Mm-hmm. How many would you say you read, just so I can sample this?
How many have I read? I would say, well, counting Reclaiming History, all of it, and the CD-ROM, that should count as like 4 books.
Oh, whoa, you completed that? You actually completed that.
I did, yeah. Now look, some of it I skimmed, okay? But I definitely wanted to hear what he had to say. So, I mean, let's say like 30, probably 30 books.
Okay, fair enough. I just want to stop you there real quick and say a couple of things. First of all, Reclaiming History, you said you skimmed some. I almost counted you among people that I can count on one hand that I know that actually read the whole thing. Okay, which is exactly what I can count on one hand. Actually, you would make the fifth finger, the fifth digit, okay? So that's how many of us I know actually read the whole book and went through the CD-ROM.
Big.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's that much of a pain in the neck. It is a snoozer as far as I'm concerned. It's awful.
Uh-huh.
But I tortured myself with it. And anyway, but again, as far as I know, certainly there's only 4 people that have actually completed that book. Now, 30, do you realize what a fractional sample that is of the available literature?
Yes.
Okay, so I stopped counting. Yeah. I stopped counting at the completed books I read just for the record in comparison. I stopped counting. I lost count at 300.
I think, but at a certain point, there starts to be overlap, though, doesn't there? Oh, I mean, not for everything, but for a lot of issues, right?
Oh, overlap? Are you kidding me? I can tell what era the book was written in based on the template it's on. You know, there's a certain template that occurs, and it then prevails in the literature for about 3 or 4 years before the new template comes out, and there are a slew of books that come along with it, because I read this stuff from the beginning of the canon to, well, today. Honestly, you know, one way or another, and I don't read them all. No, I can't, because, again, I think 10 or 15 years ago, an honest count of this, main, you know, published stuff, not necessarily monographs and everything, it was well over 1,000. So even my telling you I've read 300 books, I'm still, you know, 15 years ago, only at 1/3 of the possible literature that was known to exist.
Right.
And it's grown since then. So go ahead, but you're 30 books. I just wanted, for the record, to note that. But go ahead.
No, I mean, I think there's certainly more I have to learn. Let me say too, I focus on books that are on the topic that I'm working on at the time. So, for example, there's a couple books I haven't read yet that I just picked up, but like for Seth Cantor's Jack Ruby book. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a deep dive on Jack Ruby at the end of the season. So I'm about to really get into that. And then once I get through season one, I'm going to try to read all of John Armstrong's Harvey and Lee. So that's my big ambitious post season one goal. But the other thing is, as I'm going through, I kind of make my outline, and then on every issue, I go, so back to kind of the idea of solving JFK. What are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to, quote unquote, solve the assassination, right? Everybody's tried to solve it forever. I got it. But generally in the JFK assassination community, there is a split between either, you know, your lone nutter Warren Report defender, or you're a conspiracy theorist, you know, Warren Report critic, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously within the critic community, there's a lot of other splits as well on all kinds of issues. But, I hadn't seen many, many people compare the Warren Report, defender argument with the critic argument at the sub-issue level. So you know how everybody always talks about, I'm sure you hear this all the time from people, Occam's razor. Mm-hmm. You know that phrase, Occam's razor?
Of course.
It's like whatever the most, you know, the most likely thing to have happened, that's probably what happened. Well, it's easy to rule out any geopolitical, parapolitical event, you know, conspiracy theory, if you will, using Occam's razor if you just apply it at the top level. Mm-hmm. You have to apply it at the sub-issue level and go issue by issue and go, what's most likely to happen with this issue? What are the implications? Issue by issue by issue. So that's kind of what the podcast does. And on the, in terms of just tying this to reading books, I would get, to be honest with you, the book Reclaiming Parkland, by Jim DiEugenio,
right,
who I incidentally become friends with. I met him down at Kappa in Dallas. Really nice guy. But that book where he really compares basically his arguments to what does Bugliosi say, that planted the seed for my idea for this podcast, because I had never seen anybody break down the counterpoints, or even address the counterpoints. Mm-hmm. So as I made my outline, he did a lot of work for me just in that one book, sort of a lot of the big topics. But then I would encounter sort of the trajectory I went on here is, I was interested in it, read a bunch of books, read some of the books that now that I'm kind of in the game a little bit, mm-hmm. Are not, respected among sort of the reputable researchers. Like, you know, I read like the LBJ, like, Barr McClellan book.
Blood, Money, and Power.
Yeah, and some other ones that I know some people kind of look down on or whatever. But anyway, I was like interested as like an observer, but I wasn't like, I didn't think it was possible I'd ever be able to figure it out. And then I read JFK and the Unspeakable, and I started putting these things together that, and it's actually not written in the easiest way, because he jumps back and forth between talking about foreign policy and talking about like little anecdotes that support the idea of a conspiracy. But that when I got into that, I go, oh my gosh, it's definitely a conspiracy. And then I started looking at the footnote, you know, I'm an attorney by trade. So I started like, you know, going, is this really legit? And I'm like checking all the citations, and it's all legit. And so then I was certain it was a conspiracy. So then I went over to Facebook and I was thinking, let me find some like-minded people who can, we can help figure out what's up. And, you know, maybe there will be some sort of governmental hearings, or maybe we'll just figure out what's going on. Right. Like, I was so like idealistic. And then I go to these Facebook groups. Sure enough, I'm just shellacked by, the lone nutters that come with facts. Mm-hmm. And citations.
Right.
And I didn't know there were all these counterpoints that existed. So you were
kind of unaware of the lone nut theorist researcher, which is what I call them. Because I believe that is also a theory. Okay. Which is, in part supported by the government and in part undermined by the government conclusions, because we have two official mm-hmm. conclusions regarding the case. One by the Warren Commission, which states that Oswald acted alone. One by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which states that Oswald acted, but in concert with others, most likely. Mm-hmm. Which are two separate and equal conclusions by the U.S. government, right? One way or another.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting to me because you brought up a couple of things, and I just was wondering if you were aware of them. So if you don't mind, I'd like to check. You know, the Parkland argument, the DiEugenio book. So you're aware of the mm-hmm. evolution of that book, that he did a series on Black Op Radio, right? Countering.
Yes.
And he put it online at first, where he wrote very extensive articles making the argument point by point, going through that book. And at a certain point, even during that same time period, made an approach to Leonardo DiCaprio's father, George DiCaprio, mm-hmm. who was supposed to be involved in making a movie based on certain books. And Jim went to George DiCaprio to try and argue the case that this would be a terribly and poorly founded conspiracy that he would be propagating. And I believe he was successful because DiCaprio did not release a movie where he was going to play a particular character, and it was going to be based on the C-Day scenario and all that. But this is all during the same time period. So at one time, a virtual version of that book was available online for free. And I know this because I printed it out, and it's somewhere in my archive stash. And I thought it was very important, well done, and everything else. And I've got my disagreements with Jim, but he did an excellent job there countering the Vince Bugliosi scenarios regarding all of the research community, etc. Also, regarding the two Oswalds, you know, a lot of people think that it's Armstrong who came up with that theory, but I mean to tell you that you have to be aware of a guy named Popkin, who was a professor
who wrote about, okay,
so you're aware of that too, then, that this is not a new theory either. It's just that John Armstrong, whose theory I do not agree with also, did a hell of an extensive amount of research, absolutely proving that there seems to be an intentional convolution of the records regarding this historical character, Lee Harvey Oswald. Whether you believe that there were two separate guys and they began from childhood, or I don't want to take the next hour talking to you about that. I'm just saying that it is.
It's wild. I mean, yeah. it's something.
Well, I'm doing this more for the listener who might not be fully read in on all these things, because you're about to go into it and break it down, and I want them to capture this process with you, you know, where you're at with it. My apologies for interrupting you again, but, and I do want to just shut up and sit back. And by the way, the way you script out your podcast and everything, this is very cool that I'm hearing you talk like this. Because you are actually a really good voice actor as well. Just objectively, forget what the topic is. Very solid sort of announcer. I'm surprised you're not getting a little work, a little voiceover work, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I used to do, I actually went to journalism school to be a broadcast major and decided to go to law school instead. But I actually, and in terms of the production, which you mentioned, the goal of the podcast was to do two things, to be accessible and appealable to people that just kind of have a passing interest. Mm-hmm. And also, three things to be accessible and appealable. And that's why I started the music kind of breaks it up. We do a little like 20-second music blocks in between new subjects just so you can kind of like digest what you just heard. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
By the way, also an odd commentary on Dr. Douglas's book there, where you said it was sort of hard to read. I thought, personally, somebody who's been steeped in this stuff for a very long time, that his book was actually one of the more accessible books as far as appealing to the average person who might not be well read in. I thought exactly the opposite of what you just said when I encountered that book. And by the way, I'm partially responsible for why there's an audiobook version of that book. But anyway, that's another story.
Oh, that's cool. Let me just clarify what I meant by that.
Sure.
It's well written and I enjoyed reading it, mm-hmm. but it jumps back and forth between a discussion of foreign policy to, like, within the same chapter mm-hmm. It jumps topics without finishing. Then it'll come back to the topic. So my preference would have just been to have a whole chapter on, you know, Vietnam, then have a whole chapter on Indonesia, and then have, but it's cool. You don't get to tell the director how to make their movie, and I love the book. So,
well, Jim's intent, and I only know this from his own words because I was speaking to him at the time he was writing that, and at the time he revised it when Simon and Schuster purchased it. You know, and I really appreciated his work, and it's very valuable. And his intent was to create an idea in someone's mind that there is this overall darkness, if you will, the unspeakable itself, that, you know, instead of being bogged down in, is this the mafia, is this the CIA, and splitting those hairs, to try and give this idea. That's why he uses Merton as as the opener there, and goes through it. Mm-hmm. Also, there's you know, personal reasons why he does that as well. But put that aside. From a writer's point of view, he's trying to present a generalization here, a wider picture, as opposed to getting into the granular and presenting the straight narrative. Now, as someone who is a journalist and a lawyer, or someone who studied both of those disciplines, and they are disciplines, you have to be a storyteller. And you have to be able to lay it out. And even as a lawyer, by the way, a lot of people don't think of this, but much of what a lot of types of lawyers wind up doing, if they're doing their own work, is writing stories, basically. Telling mm-hmm. the story, whether it's a crime, or it's a damage, or it's a violation of contract, is you're laying out stories, either for a judge or for a jury to consume, for them to be entered into the record, so that they can be read and understood, right? So that is something that is important here in the way I think you're viewing this, as well as the very basic. And look, I have nothing more than a high school diploma. So, but I did take journalism classes in high school and junior high school, and I do know enough that there is an orderly way with which a journalist presents. Okay. Or at least when you're an actual disciplined, you know, standard journalist who practices journalism, you are someone who lays out things in a certain way. So I now understand. That's right. That would make sense to me, that book would present itself to you as something that's not, not badly written, but not written the way that you would have presented it.
I think it's great if you're reading to, just generally learn about it. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. I'm making like a very small, like, nitpicking observation, but it's great. I'm for it. I'm a big fan.
No problem.
So, mm-hmm. but, at any rate, yeah. So like the bottom line, what we're trying to do in the podcast is, we want it to stand up, obviously, to, you know, people like you and even people like, you know, Fred Litwin, or, you know, people who are, on the other side of the coin. I want everyone to agree, because here's what I realized as I'm in my, you know, I went through my 6 month period where I'm just doing Facebook battles with people, and I'm just like in the comments, and we're just going, this is what would always happen in every single argument. One person raises a point. The other person goes, okay, but what about this? They don't address the point that was raised. They raise a different point. And it's just so slippery that they don't commit to the issue. So I thought, we got to do something that pins everybody down issue by issue. And the other thing is, another reason I feel okay calling it Solving JFK is because at the end of every episode, I go, hey, this is a big topic. I'm not going to get everything right. And if I missed anything, or if I got something wrong, or if I left out an important fact that would provide context, email me your citation, and we'll do a rebuttal episode. So we just did our first recap and rebuttal episode for the first, like, six substantive episodes we did, where we basically went issue by issue and said, okay, here's the issue. You know, for example, could Oswald have been in place to fire the shots at 12:30? Well, the Warren Report says that Howard Brennan says he saw Oswald there, and, you know, Charles Givens was out and saw Oswald on the sixth floor at noon. So looks like he probably did it. Okay. And then, what is the conspiracy argument? Well, the conspiracy argument is that, you know, Carolyn Arnold sees Oswald at 12:25 on the second floor. That's kind of, you know, kind of tough for him to be in place. Mm-hmm. And then what are, you know, you know, all the granular arguments. So we kind of go back and forth. And then I give my take, which is, on any given issue, I give it a rating. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the ratings, it's basically a 1 to 5, from strong Warren Report, leans Warren Report, inconclusive, leans toward conspiracy, strongly suggests conspiracy. And in the first few episodes, I kind of went inconclusive on most topics. The only thing I didn't go inconclusive on is, could Oswald have been in place? I went that leans conspiracy. So I'm talking about like the documentation for the gun, the documentation for the P.O. box, the palm print on the rifle, all the evidence, you know, was it a Mauser or a Carcano? All the evidence that's in the school book depository is kind of what we covered so far, plus Roger Craig. Now we're getting it, the whole, all of his things that he says he saw. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting into, we just put the episode that came out yesterday, we're getting into, Dealey Plaza. So we're going to have 4, maybe 5 episodes on Dealey Plaza and all the witness statements. But like I was saying, rebuttals, we do rebuttals as well. So I had 7 rebuttals. Mm-hmm. And about 5 of them came from one guy. You know, some of those rebuttals, made me change my, position, on things. So specifically, The 2162, I don't really change my position, but I don't know if you're familiar with the idea that there's this form 2162 that you're supposed to have for the shipment of firearms, and that wasn't in place for Oswald at the post office box.
Yeah, it's not present, right. Mm-hmm.
So, the rebuttal that I got, was, hey, that only applied to handguns and concealed weapons. Here's the statute and here's the actual form, which references the concealed weapons section. So now there's a counter argument that Mark Lane is the one that sort of started this whole thing about 2162. And he cites to the original postal code record of 1963. And no one can find it. I can't find the original. Nobody can find the original.
Right.
So if we're just looking at the documents we have, it does kind of look like that form wasn't required for rifle shipments, but that doesn't change my position overall. I'm just, if that was your main thing you were relying on, I don't know if you can rely on it. That's all.
Well, he also allegedly received a handgun.
I don't have to get it all right, is the point. Yeah, I'm relying on people to help me.
Okay. So a couple of things here. He also allegedly received a handgun, which he allegedly shot Tippett with, right? So there's that also. It's a separate shipment. Okay.
I only know this because this is part of a conversation I've had with a rebuttal guy. Mm-hmm. That was shipped by REA. There was a specific, like, third party intermediary that actually delivered that one. So that one followed the rules.
Right. Railway Express. Exactly.
Yeah, Railway Express. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. So no problem. But also I'm just entering in a couple of, ideas here. Okay.
Sure, yeah.
Imagining what the rebuttal is. Cause again, I haven't listened to this episode yet. But I'm wondering if also, they present the counter to the two witnesses that you just mentioned, because, Brennan, first of all, people pointed this out in the 1960s, he's not wearing his glasses. And also, if you
sure.
take a look at the, you know, the approximate moments where the shot could have been seen, he doesn't appear to be looking up if you look at the photographic all evidence. Right. But okay, let's put Brennan aside, for a moment. Gibbons is a problem too, because this guy is,
sure.
you know, going out and getting his cigarettes and all this other stuff, mm-hmm. if you read his testimony, and is problematic because, in my opinion, based on what I could track about this, that guy had a record and was sort of pressured and intimidated.
Right. Correct.
So, you know, this is two counters here. Could a guy
right.
give answers that, you know, look, any guy who was caught by the cops who has a record who might be afraid about going back to jail or being held accountable somehow, might turn around and answer to the cops what they want to hear, whether it's the FBI, the police, the Warren Commission, any individual of authority. And Gibbons, I believe, is an example of this. Now, that doesn't mean that he's lying, but it does mean that we have a potential here for manipulation of the witness. Brennan, I don't believe. He put out a whole book, allegedly, of his account, right? What was it? Eyewitness to History, I think it was called, something like that. And, you know, I don't believe him for a second. But it's there. And I get it. I get it. And I know that you're going at both of these arguments. And I urge people to take a listen to this episode because the way that you've gone back and forth on this, has been fair and responsible, which is unusual, quite honestly, because as you described, I don't know if you've ever taken note or if you bothered to look to see if I'm, in any of those Facebook groups, because I do have a presence on Facebook, but I don't post often. You'll find that as little as I post on Facebook, I almost never enter into those discussions in the groups on Facebook for JFK. And it is precisely because of what you just described. It becomes a pointless and ridiculous, well, I have an eyewitness that I read this or I saw this. Or And it's like, okay, look, hearsay evidence, first of all, is a problem. What else do you have?
Right.
Secondly, if all you do is rely on the documentation, you're also missing the greater big picture.
Yes.
You know, so both of these things are valid, and nobody ever seems to stay on topic with these discussions.
Right.
So there's virtually never a useful discussion on Facebook regarding even the most granular issue. You know, look, did he actually get the gun shipped to him? You could begin with the handwriting problem. You could begin with the missing pieces of records, right, allegedly, because we have a P.O. box, you know, record, which is, you know, two different P.O. boxes, first of all. One in New Orleans, one in Texas. Both of them, the records are a bit askew. So you have stuff that's clearly missing.
Right.
Now, is it happenstance? Is it just, you know, bureaucracy being inefficient and sloppy? Or is it intentionally missing? I leave that for somebody else to judge, but I will say both possibilities are valid. But even that, there's a whole lot of questionable stuff all the way around with did he actually possess the weapon? You know, as far as what the weapon is, I think the Mauser argument is specious, but people make that argument anyway. And you also brought up Roger Craig, but go ahead.
All right. So, okay. Just to, let me, respond to each of those in turn real quick. Okay. So on the P.O. box, the thing that's the most interesting there is that Harry Holmes, the Dallas postal inspector, was informant T2.
Right.
It was later disclosed, and T2 is the one who procured a copy of Oswald's outgoing mail to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in April of 1963.
Right.
So the question becomes, and this is a rebuttal I got on the podcast too, because I said the FBI was monitoring Oswald's mail. I just sort of made that jump. Mm-hmm. Someone said, no, that's not true. And I said, okay, fair enough. I'm making that inference because they did it on this one occasion. So if you don't believe that they were checking his mail, you have to believe that this single piece of mail was intercepted on this one occasion. And it just happened to be something the Warren Report needed, the Warren Commission needed. You know what I mean? Fair Play for Cuba stuff. So anyway, so it easily could have been, I end up coming out inconclusive on the issue just based on the arguments and the evidence that exists. But the point is, it definitely could have been, you know, manufactured that he got it because they had somebody in place to set it up. And then Harry Holmes went to Oswald's, interrogation. Why? Well, you look at his Warren Commission testimony, and he goes, I dropped my wife off at church and it just didn't feel right to drive in. So I thought I should go down police department. And so I went in and they invited me to sit in on the interrogation. Huh? How does that make any sense? Okay. So there's that. Brennan and, Gibbons. Okay. So Howard Brennan, I think, I'm sure you've been to Dealey Plaza many times. Have you stood there at the fountain? I'm sure you have, and looked up at the sixth floor for Brennan's view.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Of course.
That he would have had. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's possible to identify someone's face that you've never seen before from that distance.
Well,
that's
not
just
only
my
that,
take.
Yeah. No, well, not only that, but don't forget, you got to throw in he's identifying his height from that vantage
right.
point. I mean, realistically, yeah. do you think that you could do that? If you know, again, there's a whole lot of things going on there. And this is a good example, though, of how someone can get basically, I mean, you know, hate to use the expression, but sort of thrown into the weeds regarding trying to break down all these things.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. Now, people who are not intensely interested will often tune out at this point, you know, not necessarily
sure.
to my show, but what I'm saying, and I don't care if they do, that's what they do. But what I'm saying is, you'll sort of tune out because it becomes a bit too complex. Right? They want the shorter
right.
answer. And I get it. I totally get it. But there's so much more here because
uh-huh.
of all the work that's been done. So, by the way, continue.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then on Charles Gibbons, you were mentioning that, you know, he had a criminal record. There's an FBI report from that mentions a conversation with Lieutenant Jack Reville from the Dallas Police,
mm-hmm.
where he says he personally knows of instances where he's changed his testimony before in exchange for money.
Mm-hmm.
So now that doesn't mean that he did. It's just that he knows that he has in other cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was the other thing you had mentioned? I forgot off the top of my head. But at any rate, yeah, there's there are a lot of sub-issues that come up. And, yeah, we just try to hit each of them as they come. And, you know, the thing is, you end up being inconclusive for a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're just looking at that issue in a vacuum, which is that's sort of the unique thing about what I'm trying to do, is just look at the issue in a vacuum and then also tell everybody, you know, okay, this is where it comes in the case. Like, this is why it matters. But, you know, as we talk about the Facebook conversations, what I realized is that, because, you know, they would raise evidence, and I'd be like, oh, man, I get how they could think that.
Mm-hmm.
But it all comes down to your inference. So what I'm trying to show people is, like, you know, here's all the evidence. Let's get it on the table so that we all agree about the known facts. Now,
mm-hmm.
some of these facts are disputed, sure. Now, why are they disputed? A lot of times the facts are disputed because of the inferences people make. So that comes up most often is – whenever there's in some sort of instance of evidentiary impropriety. So here's the classic example is, Lieutenant Day lifting the palm print from the barrel of a gun and then sending it in the mail on an index card, and it shows up a week later. Right. So, and of course, you know, he didn't wrap the palm print in cellophane, but he did wrap the trigger guard in cellophane. There's a whole thing about the conversation with FBI agent Vincent Drain. And Drain says that, you know, Day didn't tell him about the palm print. Day says, no, I told you. So if you're a Warren Report defender, you take a case like that and you go, oh, I side with Lieutenant Day. He's acting in good faith. He just made a mistake. You go, innocent mistake. That sort of is your bias.
Yeah.
On the conspiracy side, if you see this, any evidentiary problem, you tend to go, oh, they're framing him. They're generating evidence. You're less likely to go, he was negligent. He just made a poor choice.
Right.
So, like,
have you ever heard of the book First?
The biggest.
I'm sorry. Have you ever heard of the book First Day Evidence?
Yeah, is that Gary Shaw?
No, that would be Lieutenant Day's book, a co-author.
Oh.
Okay. And
I knew he wrote a book, but yeah, no, I didn't know that's what it was called.
Okay, First Day Evidence, which is the first time, and I believe it was released in the 1990s. You might want to double check me on that. I'm not absolutely certain. Again, a lot of it's a blur. But taking a look at that, that's the first time he actually lays out a whole lot of this stuff in a complete narrative. And it's really funny because it doesn't quite comport with earlier statements. It's rather interesting. I'm not saying that. See, here's the problem with me, is I'm the guy who's willing to call BS on people that are relying on their inferences more than the evidence, and on all sides. This is why with some people I'm popular in the community, with others I am not, because I will undermine stuff that I think is poorly supported, and it doesn't matter which side it came from. So, although I am a conspiracy advocate, full disclosure, right?
Sure.
So anyway, back to this point, it's very interesting to me as well that not only do we have instances like that where 30 years later, 40 years later, somebody finally fills in the gaps, okay, one way or another. But it's interesting to me that there are so many instances here where, yes, indeed, your default position is a lot of times the sort of Rorschach guideline. If you are someone who is a conspiracy advocate, which is the phrase I use, you'll often see many of these things, which could be indeed be mistakes, as nefarious and so on. But there's another thing to bring up here regarding the FBI, and of course the agent that was, you know, welcomed into the interrogation, Holmes there, right? Postal Inspector right. Holmes. Well, you know, funny thing about that is when one takes a look at the access and interactivity between the USPS, you know, the United States Postal Service, and the FBI, they do work in concert quite well. And they do retrieve information from them constantly. We know that at that time, J. Edgar Hoover had active programs regarding everybody's mail almost, you know, like anything that could be seen as problematic. You know, so the idea that it's just, oh, very strange that Holmes is there, to me it's not so strange. Because in a de facto sense, they are agents for the FBI when it comes to collecting of intelligence, one way or another. Now, are they technically agents? No. But they do assist often with collection of intelligence as a practical matter, especially during that time period, but beyond it. Now, look, we've been at this for about 45 minutes, so I don't know if you'd like to take a little break and maybe, you know, continue just a little bit more. I don't want to, you know, take up too much of your time tonight, but I would love to continue to expand on these things a little bit and get back to the story of your podcast, because I only off-roaded a bit with you on these subjects to give people an idea of what your thought process is.
Sure.
And to show them the very responsible way, and this is now my critique, the very responsible way with which I see you handling both sides, whether it is the lone nut theorist or the conspiracy advocate, I see you handling the arguments from both sides quite adequately, quite objectively, throughout the beginning of the podcast. And it seems to me as though an attempt to settle this is right there. You know, and again, it's impossible for anybody to have gone through all of the literature, all the podcasts, every single thing that's ever been released. It's a mountain of media. But
right.
The evidence itself, even though some people would argue it's finite, it's continuously expanding as well. The examination of it. I mean, we even have the recent documents, which I know just from skimming your descriptions, you went over that a little bit, the document releases, stuff like that. You know, which I was at those press conferences and somewhat involved with that. Yes. Well, I was at the press conferences virtually, you know, because they held them virtually from the press club and all that. But, you know, morally, the Mary Farrow Foundation press conferences.
Right. Yeah.
And all that. And I found a lot of that really interesting and what the mainstream media did with it as opposed to other media sources. It's very interesting. And when we get into that, of course, we also have the allegation that the CIA briefed a lot of the corporate media ahead of time. And there's a very logical and practical reason for doing that. And that is that most of the people that are reporters nowadays have no clue what it is they're being told when these things are being released. They literally do need guidance. Someone could ascribe that as a benign purpose for the CIA giving them a narrative ahead of time. But anyway, you know, we could also look at it in a different way. But morally, in the Mary Fowle Foundation, and of course Larry Schnapp, who's been on this show, and Bill Simpich, who is the lead attorney in the case now, you know, going forward against the Biden administration and generally against the executive branch regarding the JFK Records Collection Act, that is yet another sub-issue. And you seem to be making an attempt to really give a good sample of the entire universe of the issue. So I just want to say that I'm really, really happy with the job you're doing so far. And I'm only a couple episodes in, and I'm going to give everybody the links, not in the chat room, but I'll put them in the show notes when this is a podcast. So look down. You'll have hyperlinks to Solving JFK on YouTube and at least some other place where the podcast is. Did you get a website? Matter of fact, why don't you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm.
We'll take a little break, and then I'll let you give a conclusion to this whole thing, if you don't mind.
Okay, great. Yeah, that sounds good, Chuck. Yeah, the website is solvingjfkpodcast.com, and every episode I have the transcript and my sources, and every assertion of fact is cited. So you can kind of see where I'm getting things from. This season, we are just trying to figure out, I was talking before about inferences. We're trying to figure out, well, what do you have to believe from the record? Like, what are the boundaries of the things you can believe? And, like, what are the open questions, really? You know what I mean? So, open question, people that have studied the case, for example, as we're in Dealey Plaza, who's the guy impersonating a Secret Service agent on the grassy knoll? Mm. This isn't some crazy tinfoil thing. There's four people that saw him. Now, one of those people is Gordon Arnold, who everybody thinks is full of crap. You know, there's like, you know, a lot of people don't believe him, but there are, you know, Officer Joe Smith and Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman. They're both law enforcement. It's in their affidavits. You know what I mean?
True.
So it's something's going on there. So that's kind of the thing where I jump off of the fence, is where I can hold on to real evidence and go, this doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? And by, for example, the Mauser.
Hold on with the Mauser. Just hang on. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But let's stick with the first example you gave I'm sorry. It's just, I wanna keep people's speed at a certain rate here, if you don't mind.
Right.
And,
I got you.
And here's the thing. I have a simple and benign explanation for that Secret Service agent being spotted all over the place. And you know what? A lot of people on the conspiracy advocate side of things do not like my explanation, but it's backed up by evidence.
What is it?
Well, you know what? I think I'm going to give that to people on the other side of the break. What I want to do with you is get a summation, if you will. Okay, there we go. Using a lawyer term. I want to get a summation about this and also give people a bit of a tease. I want them to go and experience your podcast. I'm endorsing it as one of the very few things that I think is useful out there regarding this in a series, in a collection, just as I fully and full-throatedly endorse Black Op Radio as a collection of information, which is extremely large in its archive, regarding authorship, media, the case itself, etc. I don't necessarily endorse everything Len has ever allowed on air over there, but, you know, 20 years worth of work, more than 20 years, and he's put out a lot of good stuff, and it is a repository of information. I am telling you that among the people who have decided to make a podcast focusing on JFK, my guest tonight, Matt Crumpton, solvingjfkpodcast.com. Did I get the website right?
Yes, that's correct.
Solvingjfkpodcast.com. I endorse this as something useful. Now, I have no idea what the conclusion will be, and he did mention this is season one, so maybe we'll get to find out what the other seasons might have, what his game plan is and all that, before we're done on the Ocelli Effect. Again, solvingjfkpodcast.com, and we'll return in a couple of minutes and get a summation from Matt Crumpton after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Uncle, I'll bet you remember the time when Benjamin Fulford said that the Asian Secret Society was going to dispatch ninjas to take out the Illuminati to change the entire world for the better.
That is never gonna happen. That never did.
It never did, did it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, because there's a lot of false promises.
Fools? I can't say one.
We better not say and be polite, but there are no false promises at the Ocelli.com radio network.
That's exactly it. Not. It's truth, the point, right to the point. And this is what I like. Straight to the point.
Ocelli.
Ocelli.com.
Listen now.
Listen now.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper.
What are people saying about MyTrueEssence.net?
I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
But I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles sort of really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. Essential oils rule!
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
Revelation through conversation.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides. Take a look at what happens in a really horrible recession or worse. So you're going to have tremendous suicides, but you know what you're going to have more than anything else? Drug addiction. You will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before. And people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides. Take a look at what happens in a really horrible recession or worse. So you're going to have tremendous suicide. But you know what you're going to have more than anything else? Drug addiction. You will see drugs being used like nobody's ever used them before. And people are going to be dying all over the place from drug addiction.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Get ready for The Ocelli Effect.
To the Ocelli.com radio network.
Ocelli.com.
Well, normally that's my closing music, but back to the podcast or live stream. Of course, if you're catching the podcast, you don't care what time it is or anything like that. But I'm going to try not to take up too much more time of Matt Crumpton, because I assume that he has quite a few things going on in his life, and this is not the only thing. And I don't know how many other people have offered to promote your podcast that are podcasters, but I'm more than pleased to direct people to go to JFKSolvedPodcast.com. I did get that right again, right?
Matt? Solving JFK. Solving JFK Podcast.
I screwed it up. Sorry. You know what it is? I just probably it got convoluted with that Murder Solved website that used to be around.
Uh-huh.
Sorry. SolvingJFKPodcast.com. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, thank you. See, you always got to watch because one word in the wrong place. Okay, we did get a couple of live chat questions, which I will throw at you real fast. I think you'll be able to dispose of them quickly. But I promise to give you a very simple and benign explanation regarding the Secret Service agent. And I'm going to speak in generalities here because it's been quite a while since I studied this. But if you go ahead and do your own study, I believe you will find that what I'm saying has some validity to it. It's pretty simple. If you line up the testimonies of the individuals who allegedly spotted this Secret Service agent, and then you take a look at one particular Secret Service agent's testimony, this is all in the Warren Commission volumes, okay? If you go and take a look at this one Secret Service agent who talks about leaping from a car in the motorcade and then running around to different spots on the grassy knoll, it's very possible they all confronted one Secret Service agent who was running around briefly and jumped back onto another vehicle in the motorcade. It's very possible and very likely in my mind, considering how I tried to line up the timeline. And, you know, a little difficult, but it makes some sense that they're actually all dealing with one particular Secret Service agent whose name eludes me at the moment. But I'm sure if you go ahead, I mean, I know there's no real index in the Warren Commission report that allows you to go and do this easily. But I assure you, if you take a look at Secret Service agent testimony, you'll find a guy who legitimately enters that I jumped off, I went around to different spots, ran around, and jumped back into the motorcade. And it is not one of the guys whose names are often brought up. It's not Clint Hill. It's not, you know, it's not Reddy. It's not the guys that everybody's looking at during the sequence of film for Zapruder or anything like that. It actually starts to make a little bit of sense that it could be a legitimate Secret Service agent with legitimate ID who was not technically on the ground for very long in Dealey Plaza, but did jump out to try and get some sort of information. What the hell just happened here? Okay, that is the most benign explanation I have for that. And some people get very angry at it, but I assure you, check the Warren Commission volumes yourself, and you'll find that Secret Service agent's testimony. Now, I know everybody go, well, the Secret Service agent guys might have lied. They might have been trying to cover their butt. But I don't think this was a big issue about the Secret Service agents. Why are there so many in the plaza until later? So they would have had to have known that this was going to become an issue and had this guy's testimony entered and then printed in the official government printing office's version of the Warren Commission volumes, which came out after the report some months later when you could literally go down and buy your 26 volumes from the government printing office, okay? So all I'm saying is that to me provides a logical explanation for something that really did seem strange to many people for decades.
Yeah.
So
if you can think of the Secret Service agent's name, let me know, and I'll try to look for that as well. But no, I hadn't heard that a Secret Service agent left the motorcade and then rejoined. That's news to me.
Are you in contact with Walt Brown?
No.
Okay. I'll give you his email later on. Okay, he's the guy who, by the way, wrote the 36,000-page chronology, the assassination. Just so you know, he's also the author of many other books, including a somewhat fictional the People versus Lee Harvey Oswald, also the author of Judith Barry Baker in Her Own Words, which is not a supporting volume of Judy Baker. Okay, there's that. He was the guy who did Deep Politics Quarterly for many years. That was his publication. Does this ring any bells?
Deep Politics Quarterly sounds familiar. And this is like a book that sort of talks about the inconsistencies with Judith Barry Baker. Is that the one he's written?
Well, this is, you know, comparing her statements, her public statements, to known facts. And basically showing,
cool.
You know. But anyway, that's just part of his work. As I said, the Master Chronology he wrote, which is in CD-ROM form, if you're going to continue this, I would get it as a reference material. And I am, personal bias, I know Walt and all that, but I know a lot of these guys I'm bringing up. But he's somebody whose living room I used to go to and sit there and talk about this stuff with for hours. Okay, and he's he also appeared in The Men Who Killed Kennedy. He most prominently was featured in the thing about, you know, Johnson being part of the conspiracy, the one of the band episodes, yeah. You know. But anyway, Walt Brown, check out his work. I leave it at that.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I don't necessarily agree with anybody altogether, but but ask him about it. I guarantee off the top of his head he'll have this this complete thing. He's another guy, if you wanted to talk about Barr McClellan's book, he was sort of involved with helping Barr for a minute, and he tells a very, very funny story regarding what he thought of Blood, Money, and Power when it was actually released, and somebody sent it to him. I'll give you the punchline anyway, but the way he tells it is even better. But he was a teacher, and he had it in front of his class, and he said, I'm going to show you what happens now when you don't do a good job regarding what it is that you're researching and you're presenting a paper on. He held up the book, opened it up, read something that was completely factually inaccurate, and tossed it in the garbage in front of his class. And he was involved with helping Barr before that. So just saying, that's Walt Brown. Please continue. I want you to give a summation about this and tell people where it's going. I also have a couple of curiosities from the chat room, which I'll throw at you, and you can choose to answer whether you want to or not or whatever.
Okay.
Somebody wanted to know if you have a viewpoint on Prayer Man or the girl on the stairs, number one. Number two, also, there is a question regarding, you know, are you just relying on books or have you actually read... You know, have you actually decided to pursue certain documentation, the firsthand official evidence, or is there one that you rely on more than the other to make your presentations? And my personal question is, look, you have one season already in mind, and I'm not sure if you're done with it yet, but either way, you're talking about it as though there will be another season. Do you have a long-term game plan regarding this? Is there a sunset objective or time period or something like that for the podcast? So all those questions, you go right ahead and let me know what you want to answer.
All right. Let's start with the questions you had. Prayer Man. So this is the picture on the front steps, and it's not Billy Lovelady. It's the other guy, some other guy, because everyone goes, oh, it's Billy Lovelady. I mean, I don't really get into the game of looking at pixelated images. The same thing with like Badge Man, you know, and all that, just because I can't really tell, and I'm not really an expert on that. So Prayer Man, maybe I should look into a little bit more, but I don't have a super strong opinion on Prayer Man.
Okay.
The Girl on the Stairs, I do have an opinion on. That is one that I got off of the fence on, and I tend to think that with the now, I don't want to get super in the weeds here, but we had rebuttals on this topic as well. So there's a sort of an active back and forth conversation,
right,
going on about the Girl on the Stairs. But it, as you know, the whole, so Sandra Stiles and Victoria Adams, they see the shots fired from the fourth floor. Excuse me. And then they run down the stairs. She says 15 to 30 seconds after, Victoria Adams says, in her Warren Commission testimony.
Right.
Okay. So they get down the stairs and they don't hear Oswald in the stairs, and they, would have been going down basically at the same time as Oswald. There's only one set of stairs in the building. And, there's a whole argument of, well, she says that she saw Shelley and Lovelady in her testimony, and they went to the railroad yard right away. So if she saw them, she's mistaken about her time. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's real into the weeds, okay? But bottom line, I tend to think that the Girl on the Stairs, Barry Ernest's work, who wrote that book,
right.
You know, he goes to the National Archives. The stenographic copy is missing. And the audio tapes are missing.
Yep.
Now the original signed transcript is there, but anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think that's persuasive. In terms of the books that I've read, or am I relying on one more than other, and am I looking at primary evidence? I'm looking at primary evidence first and foremost. That's more important than books for me.
Right.
So, you know, the Warren Report, the deposition transcripts, the FBI reports, all of that is the most important. The books that I rely on the most tend to be the ones that dealt with that primary evidence, right? So I think Sylvia Meyer, Accessories After the Fact, is really good just for sort of like the very mm-hmm. basic information with citations to the record. I mentioned De Eugenio Reclaiming Parkland. That was good for sort of the back and forths. Gayton Fonzie's The Last Investigation is outstanding for mm-hmm. for the HSCA investigation. And yeah, I mean, those are sort of the one. I mean, obviously JFK and the Unspeakable, I keep coming back to, but ultimately JFK and the Unspeakable, you know, the most salacious thing about that one for me is the story of Ralph Yates. The story of Ralph Yates really got me going down this road. That's one of the Oswald lookalikes, the hitchhiker that the guy picked up and the, you know, the Wednesday before, and he's talking all this stuff about killing the president. You think you can kill the president with a rifle from a tall building? Hey, I have 4 foot long curtain rods. Can you give me a ride to work? And he gives him a ride. Where's his work? It's the school book depository building. Anyway, so, I say all that to say, the FBI report is really the salacious document. And, Douglas just did a really nice job of finding the anecdotes that were the craziest. So I'm just trying to, I'm really trying to shine a light on what a lot of other people did. You know, I hear in the JFK, assassination research community, you know, everybody says, sort of the early researchers would say, find one thing to specialize in. Right. Don't try to study everything. And I'm kind of bucking that. My whole thing is I think a lot of people have done good work. And if I can bring their good work to light, you know, in a glossy format that normal people want to listen to, that's cool. Mm-hmm. In terms of what we're doing this season and where we're going. Okay. Season one is, did the Warren Report get it right? And if not, what are the open questions? Okay. Mm-hmm. So in season one, we are looking at all of the sub issues, in terms of just different, scenes, different settings. Okay. So the Texas School Book Depository, where was Oswald when the shots were fired? Right. You know, are there fingerprints in the sniper's nest in different places? We look at Oswald's rifle and all the details behind him ordering it, and receiving it, allegedly. And then we look at, you know, how he fled the building. We're looking at Dealey Plaza right now. We will be going to a 6-part series on the medical evidence. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the medical evidence is the saga of the Parkland doctors versus, the autopsy. But luckily we have the Rosetta Stone of the medical evidence in the form of the Seibert O'Neill report, in my mm-hmm. opinion. That's sort of the magic. But anyway, so we look at that. Then we go to J.D. Tippit. We'll spend 3 or 4 episodes on J.D. Tippit. Then we go to, you know, the Texas Theater will be one of the episodes, The Apprehension. And then we look at, you know, Oswald in custody and ultimately Oswald getting killed. And I can tell you that, at the end of season one, there are going to be open questions. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I go issue by issue, and there have been 11 issues so far, and I've determined 10 of them inconclusive. Mm-hmm. And one of them leans conspiracy. Could Oswald have been in place? Mm-hmm. And I think that what ends up happening is if you're being intellectually honest and really trying to be objective, you're going to find a majority of the issues inconclusive, probably. Mm-hmm. It's just the ones that you don't find inconclusive. Once you see something, you can't unsee it. You know what I mean? Once you, there's some things that you go, oh my gosh. And then with those things, you go, well, could it have been possible? And all I'm saying with the inconclusive is that a lot of scenarios could be possible depending on what you find out later in the future. But season two is going to be, season two is going to be who was Oswald really? So this is sort of a deep biographical dive on Oswald. And then season three and Marina as well. Mm-hmm. And then season three, and season two is probably only going to be like half the length of season one. And then season three will be, if not Oswald, then who? And right. So that'll be a very long one.
Yeah.
But that's the arc. I'm trying to get down to the very end. And what I want to get down to is I'm probably going to end with, look, if you think Oswald did it alone, here's what you must believe. You're signing up to believe that, you know, all these Dealey Plaza witnesses were wrong, that, you know, the Parkland doctors were all wrong, etc. If you think that there was a conspiracy, here's what you're signing up to believe. You're signing up to believe that, you know, the autopsy is completely fabricated, mm-hmm. and that, you know, a number of FBI agents just blatantly lied and fabricated evidence. Mm-hmm. So it, both sides have uncomfortable, you know, issues that are associated with them. And I just kind of want to use the record and go, look, based on all these citations, here's what it comes down to. If you think this, you're signing up for these beliefs. If you think this, you're signing up for these things. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the bottom line.
Well, I love the concept. I think this is great. I wish I had thought of it this way myself, and thought it out better when I started doing presentations. I mean, I've made this up as I've gone along. I got just one final thing to ask you about, because now that I've heard this outline, I gotta say there's a couple of things I'm wondering if you're aware of or if you've looked at, right away. So I'll do this in the form of some authors real fast, who did some solid work that I think provides some very good guideposts for you to be able to navigate some evidence. William Law, you're aware of his work?
He's got the medical evidence book, right?
Well, yes, and probably the best collection of interviews about key players in the medical evidence you'll ever see.
Yeah, I met him in Dallas, and I just picked up his book. I shook his hand and bought his book from him. So I haven't read that yet, but I will before the I'll probably need to supplement my my medical evidence information. So yeah, that's awesome.
Definite. Okay, Larry Sneed, you ever heard of him?
No, it sounds familiar, but I'm probably thinking of Larry Schnapp or Larry Hancock.
No problem. Well, Larry Hancock is another name that's going to come up in a minute, but let's finish with Sneed first. He wrote a book called No More Silence, in which he collected together, I think, 200 interviews with Dallas police officers, which is a very good, again, it's a guidepost. I'm not saying rely on anybody's conclusion, but what I'm saying is you have very good guidebooks here. Regarding this. Of course, Larry Hancock, is another
tipping
one.
Tipping point.
I went through and did a episode on this show on every one of his books, including stuff outside of the JFK realm, which covers everything from, you know, what they call UAPs now to JFK. Uh-huh. And his very responsible and sober way of examining things is, superb and also an excellent guidepost. I'm also curious if you ever heard of Sherry Feaster.
No.
Okay, regarding medical evidence, she was a blood spatter analyst who did a crime scene investigation book, which off the top of my head is called Enemy of the Truth, I believe, and there's a longer title. She is now deceased, but she was also the sister of Deborah Conway, and from a professional crime scene investigator point of view, no other professional in her discipline has challenged her conclusions, and they're very interesting. And the evidence that she utilizes, very interesting. I would suggest it's a good guidepost as well. When it comes to Oswald and his character, have you ever heard of Ernst Titovitz?
No.
Ernst Titovitz was Oswald's best friend when he was in Minsk. And actually possesses many hours of tape recordings of Oswald, which have never been heard by the world. He's a doctor there now in Belarus. Very interesting guy. I'm one of the very few people who's ever bothered to interview Ernst Titovitz. But he got very dismayed when people misused the tape of his, of Oswald's, for, to make certain points. But he was actually his friend, studying English from a native speaker at the time when he was in Minsk. Very interesting point of view that could fill in a lot of biographical information that is not always available in anybody's book. So I would tell you that's rarefied. But the ever-changing character study of Oswald is interesting, too. Larry Hancock is currently working on that. Just so you know, a new look at Oswald and what might be a bit more of an Occam's razor approach to what we can see and what is visible and what is not necessarily visible. So I'm just saying, these are things going on. I was curious if you knew about them.
I wrote those down, so I'm gonna dive into all those things. So thank you.
Excellent.
Especially the No More Silence. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's a very, very little known book. You know, obviously, if you wanted to look at images and things like that, I mean, clearly, I'm going to suggest look at Robert Grodin's stuff.
Grodin, yeah.
You know, who I've interviewed a few times, not even on this show, but I've just kind of interviewed as part of his presentations in the past few years. And I have, like, every one of his books. But the most slots on my bookshelf that are taken up by a single author, just for the record, is Larry Hancock. You know, again, Walt Brown, if you wanted another guidepost, if you wanted to really delve into granular stuff and dates and times and curious information, his chronology, the master chronology on this, which, by the way, you mentioned Sylvia Marr. You're aware of her index, too, right?
Yeah, she's a hero.
Yeah, okay.
Made that index. She's awesome.
Yeah, okay. No, hey, look, I just wanted to check these things with you. And once again, I'm really looking forward to seeing where this goes. And now I can finally listen to the rest of Solving JFK because this is well done. Again, I know I've already repeated this to you a few times, Matt. Just bear with me a second. It's very well done. It's well scripted, and normally I'm not a fan of scripted stuff with this because there's always people really making crazy assertions one way or another. I mean, whether it's the recent series, not so recent, but fairly recent series where, you know, they're trying to prove Oswald's a Russian agent and things like this on one of those History Channel outlets of some type. You know what I'm talking about. Or it's, you know, the odd notions that come out from PBS. Or it's the underground, right? JFK into 9/11, a rich man's game. Look, it's all in there. No, it's not. But anyway,
Or it's the people thinking that the I've had some success on TikTok. Like I have like 10,000 TikTok followers, and the thing that keeps popping up is everybody keeps saying that the Secret Service driver did it on accident. Oh no, the Secret Service, Oswald did it alone, the Roy Report got it right, but the Secret Service driver tried to turn around and he accidentally shot him in the head and they covered up for him. I'm like, if you think that they would cover up for a Secret Service driver who made a mistake, I don't think that's how it works. Like,
see, that's the mortal error, you know the history of this, the mortal error book and all that. Well, you know, here we go again. And that lawsuit, which, what was it? Hickey took him to court because he was basically being blamed, and he won that court case. That book, you know, all that. But that's and still it's being revived. Excuse me. You know,
it's on Netflix. There's a documentary. That's why everybody believes it, because it's on Netflix. I mean, probably 10% of people that think there's a conspiracy think that's what happened. It's alarming.
And, well, what's even more alarming to me is the easily disproven thing that Bill Cooper propagated is still out there, and I'm still getting questions about that, you know, which is the, you know, you said driver. What you're talking about there is not even a driver. That's a guy in a follow-up car allegedly picking up an AR-15 and popping him in the back of the head accidentally. But there is a driver thing that goes on, and that's the Bill Cooper thing. The driver turned around and shot him in the face.
You're right. I was conflating the two, yes.
Yes. And it's like, oh, my God, why are you guys still doing this? That's an old, blurry film. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. And, you know, if you're old enough to remember videotapes, kiddies, I know, Grandpa, shut up. But if you're old enough to remember videotape, you keep making copies, and all kinds of weird things happen to it. But anyhow.
Can I ask you one question?
Certainly.
What is the one, or if there's a tie, one or two facts that lead you to be on the conspiracy side of things when it comes to JFK assassination?
You know, it was an aggregate of things, and oddly enough, even though I knew, look, instinctively as a small child, my first question when this was related to me in third grade, really, right, because I was born in 1972, so I'm born after the assassination, but by the time I get into third grade, you know, my teacher's describing this, my hand goes up when she describes how Oswald died. And I said, wait, whoa, hold on, you know, because I'm a street kid. So I go, the cops had him in custody and he died, so the cops killed him, right? you know, because that would be a logical conclusion, all right? Well, either the cops killed him or somebody else in the cell killed him. Well, nobody else was in the cell with him, so that leads me to believe the cops had to have killed him. Oh, no, this guy Jack Ruby. I said, something ain't right here. But outside of that, I accepted the lone nut theory for quite a long time as a child. And was just like, something's wrong, but I don't know. He must have done it, right? And honestly, when I started to investigate it, it was really to disprove conspiracy theory. That was my idea in my mind. For conversational purposes, I want to be able to say in a room, nah, listen, you conspiracy guys are nuts. And as I actually investigated the evidence, I could not honestly make that argument anymore. So the argument that I started with came apart, and then I wound up diving deeper and deeper, and all it's ever done is reinforce my belief through very small issues over and over again. It's not one thing that pulls it apart for me. It's the whole thing falls apart in my mind because there's too many problems. Nothing is perfect, especially if you're looking at it, and any historical event requires what they used to call perspective, you know, that concept, that French concept in history that you need 75 years before you can adequately report
can judge.
On. So, and I get it, but this was just after the birth of modern, what they call modern historical writing, right? Where, you know, with the rise and fall of the Third Reich, effectively, that changed the literary sort of posture when it comes to what's acceptable regarding what history accepts in a literary sense. And historians write differently than your mainstream authors do. And I understand all that. And yet, I saw it coming apart left and right. You could make so many arguments in so many different directions that, you know, it's just too shaky. I don't see how he would have been convicted. And indeed, he was never convicted, not in a literal sense. So, you know, to me, it's like it just keeps falling apart the more I learn. But that is the way that I see it. I'm also predisposed to not trust government, not trust authority figures, not trust the police, not trust J. Edgar Hoover, not trust, you know, and so on. So my sort of anti-establishment bent probably shapes part of what it is I choose to look at. But on the other hand, even an objective look gives you, I mean, like you said, 11 issues, 10 of them I got to come up with inconclusive. Which, in a literal sense, means in a legal sense, in a direct sense, you can't convict, at the very least. So where do we go from here? Let's find out what did happen, because here's the reality. No matter what, no matter what arguments we enter, this thing happened one way. Now, if we can discover that, even if it's piece by piece, perhaps we can lay a lot of things to rest. And I'd be more than happy to do so. If there was conclusive evidence that could be provided either way. But I leave it open. You know, I still say that there is the possibility that almost anybody could be right unless they're clearly making up things, and some people have purposely inserted information into this that they knew was inaccurate, incorrect, claiming connections to things or being present at things that they were not. And there are many, many examples of that as well. So we have a very murky pond, even though it's larger than a pond, it's a sea compared to most historical events as far as the different investigations and analyses, if you will. So this is where we're at, Matt, and I really like what you're doing, because I'm not saying you're actually going to solve the case, but it is a good, clean way of using critical thought to examine something that is so complex. So and I appreciate what you're doing, and I'm looking very forward to not only the rest of this season, but where you go from here. I hope you continue on with it. And any help that I can provide to you, by the way, just ask. I will gladly provide you, point you to. I don't claim to be the mass expert, but I do have a familiarity with the media that's been produced, the things that are available, primary evidence and otherwise. And I could possibly help you, point you in the right direction, if you want to explore this, which I would love to do. And I'm not even saying I'm the best at it, but I offer my services freely. So,
I appreciate that. And thanks again for having me on. And, as you're listening to it, and as your viewers, your listeners are listening to it, if you hear me leaving something out, you know, by all means, I give my email address every episode. It's on the website, solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Like, let me know and I'll correct the record, because when it's all done, we're going to do one big episode or maybe two episodes, putting all the issues together, making our judgments on every single issue, and then going, here's the open question, here's the conclusion, here's the conclusion, all the way down. So, there you go. It'll be fun. And again, I do appreciate it. And I've written down the name of those books. I'm going to order all those, here when I get off with you.
Excellent. And again, if you find yourself in a sub issue or whatever, I mean, I'd be more than happy to provide you with a couple other suggestions. SolvingJFKPodcast@gmail.com is the place. If you guys, I'll put that email address also in the show notes, cause I always provide places for people to go with the shows afterwards. And it is SolvingJFKPodcast.com, the main website, but you're available on YouTube, through most places where audio podcasts are available. Certainly that's just the way it is. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I'm everywhere podcasts are, very active on TikTok and Instagram, and then YouTube and Facebook as well.
Ah, excellent. So available on social media. We'll give you all this stuff. And if you go to solvingjfkpodcast.com, I'm sure all of that is there. Maybe you should get a link tree together too, right? To give people a little, here's my social, here's my, all right, all that. Anyway, sorry, I'm done giving you suggestions, Matt Crumpton.
You're good, my man. You're good.
You're doing an excellent job. Chuck. And I thank you, and I thank you guys for listening. I know this was a bit more than maybe Matt wanted to do, about an hour and a half, talking about the Solving JFK podcast, which I do recommend. And I've only sampled a couple episodes, but telling you guys, if you're interested in the topic, you will not be disappointed. SolvingJFKPodcast.com and SolvingJFKPodcast@gmail.com if you want to contact Matt, and I suggest you do. Anyway, Matt, thanks so much. And no matter what you're doing, man, I hope you have a pleasant rest of the night.
Yeah, Chuck, have a great night. Thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it.
Excellent, guys. And no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember this. I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.